life to miss it.
Want to see the world from a totally different perspective?
Ready for provocative conversation?
Intriguing stories?
And inspiration?
Then don't touch that dial.
Welcome
to Talk with Francesca.
She'll give you something to talk about all week long. Now, here's Francesca.
What if you took the time to really soak it?
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Talk with Francesca. I'm Francesca Bastarash, and you are listening to AM 1510 WWZN Revolution Boston. My website is talkwithfrancesca.com. Feel free to submit a question or comment there. I love to get your emails. I read every single one of them. You can also find me on Facebook at Talk with Francesca. Okay, we've got a fabulous, fabulous weekend ahead of us. Enjoy your time off. All right, here goes. Will Massachusetts be one of the few states to allow a mentally competent adult to request a lethal prescription to die? Or are we just amusing ourselves to death? Should society be able to claim a moral stake in such a private decision? Today, we're going to be discussing this hotly debated issue of physician-assisted dying. What are your thoughts on the Death with Dignity Act? Should it be legal? Should it be illegal? Why or why not? So I want to know what you think. So email me at host@talkwithfrancesca.com. We have a very robust conversation ahead. The first half of Talk with Francesca, I have two guests who are strongly, strongly opposed to the Death with Dignity Act. However, the second half of Talk with Francesca, I have two guests that are strongly in favor of it. Dr. Marcia Angel, a leading advocate for the Death with Dignity Act, and Heather Klisch, whose father, living in Oregon, decided that this was the way he would choose to end his life. So you decide. It'll certainly give you something to talk about all this weekend. So here with me now, live, loud, and local, in the studio is Dr. Elizabeth Lamont, a medical oncologist at Massachusetts General Hospital and associate professor of medicine and healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School. Her main endeavor is research in the area of cancer care in the elderly, and she has published extensively in the area of cancer care at the end of life. And also with me is Dr. Linda Young. She is the immediate past president of the Massachusetts Medical Society, which recently reaffirmed its longstanding opposition to physician-assisted suicide.
Okay, thank you both for making the trip to the studio today, and welcome to Talk with Francesca.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, I would like to read the American Medical Association's Code of Medical Ethics. A little piece of it here. As the American Medical Association's Code of Medical Ethics states, it is understandable, although tragic, that some patients in extreme duress may come to decide that death is preferable to life. However, allowing physicians to participate in assisted suicide would cause more harm than good. We're going to hold that thought for a second. Physician-assisted suicide is fundamentally incompatible with the physician's role as healer. Instead of participating in assisted suicide, physicians must aggressively respond to the needs of patients at the end of life in order that these patients continue to receive emotional support, comfort care, adequate pain control, respect for patient autonomy, and good communication. That's just a piece of it, obviously. Obviously, both of you share this philosophy. So let me just start by throwing out this question. How does it cause more harm than good?
I can answer that.
Okay. Dr. Young.
I think that there's a couple of reasons, one of which is we may not have the right diagnosis, and perhaps we're wrong. And if we are, then to have a physician prescribe medication that would allow a patient to end their life, and we were wrong, would be definitely great harm.
Absolutely it would. But let's say there's an 85-year-old woman who has stage 4 lung cancer, and she's been given 3 months to live. Now, that is clearly the right diagnosis. She's seen several doctors. In that case, what is your feeling?
Well, I'm representing our policy, mm-hmm. and which is from the Massachusetts Medical Society. Mm-hmm. We definitely are in agreement with the American Medical Association. And there are other methods, such as hospice, palliative care, which would allow a patient to have a day as good as they can mm-hmm. with pain medication, with make them as comfortable as possible, and let the disease, which is going to end up killing them anyway.
Dr. Lamont, you are an oncologist, and you deal with a lot of older folks. Is that right?
That's true.
And so, and how do you feel about this?
So, you know, I'm not representing any group. These are really just my own thoughts mm-hmm. as a physician who cares for folks at the end of life. There's sort of two big issues. One is the ethical issue that Dr. Young articulated so nicely in the AMA statement. And the second is a concern regarding logistics. So in a perfect world, if things were going to go exactly as spelled out in the act, that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't support it. But what I am even more worried about is that this will become a way to manage patients clinically. In other words, we know that that we can improve patients' pain, improve their suffering,
mm-hmm.
improve depression and decrease mood. And it might become a situation where the sort of the path of least resistance was not helping people to
mm-hmm.
to close up the issues in their lives, but to immediately, you know, go for physician-assisted suicide. The other concern is, a logistic concern would be, you know, is this really what the patient wants?
Ah.
And, you know, is this what the family wants instead? You know, you worry about issues of coercion.
Mm-hmm. But there'd be safeguards against that, don't you think?
Oh, gosh, I think this is so tricky. I really do. Because, you know, the practice is very different than the theory.
Well, yeah. Okay, well, let me just ask you this. What's the difference between physician-assisted dying and putting aside the technology that would keep one tethered to life if someone is actively in the dying process? I mean, like, you know, really actively in it. The oxygen level is gradually turned down. You've got the morphine drip to keep the patient comfortable and calm. I mean, what is the difference there?
So the ethicists, and Dr. Young, correct me if I'm wrong, but the ethicists like to talk about what's called the double effect. So if you have a patient, say, who is really at the end of life, they're very short of breath, you're going to increase the morphine so that they're no longer short of breath, but you fully realize that that's also going to stop their breathing entirely. You're increasing the morphine to palliate the symptoms. You're mm-hmm. not increasing the morphine to end their life. And so it's a fundamental difference.
I think another way to state it is to look at the ordinary versus the extraordinary means of prolonging life. So what you were alluding to was a use of a ventilator
mm-hmm.
or feeding mm-hmm. tubes
mm-hmm.
or things like that.
Right.
And I think that those are patients who are generally not able to make these kinds of decisions themselves.
So what is the purpose then of keeping them alive, if it is their decision? I mean, if they're in so much not just physical, but emotional agony, then why, and if they want out, why are you promoting keeping them alive? This is what they want. They're saying this. They've asked for this a number of times with this Death with Dignity Act. They're asking for it. I think they have to, I don't know the exacts, but they have to ask for it a number of times. It isn't, you know, just a bad mood day, you know, a low mood. It is. They have asked for it several times.
I can actually let you know what is being asked of them in this particular ballot issue, if that's what we're talking about. Basically, the patient must have a diagnosis that is incurable and irreversible.
Right.
And in two physicians' diagnoses, that they are within, the patients, not the physicians, are within death of 6 months or less.
Right.
The patient has to be mentally capable of making and communicating this decision, and I think that's important. They need to do this twice verbally and once written.
Yep.
And if there is any doubt as to the medical status of the patient, then that may or may not, that may be causing impaired judgment, then there has to be a referral for a mental health counseling. So I think when you look at that, it certainly does have some safeguards in there.
It really does, yeah.
And I think it all goes back to ethically, when we became physicians, we took oaths. They may not have necessarily been the Hippocratic Oath, but they were oaths that was pretty much going way, way back of physician do no harm. And in many physicians' minds, this is doing harm.
Dr. Lamont, are you obviously, if you're dealing with cancer patients and people who are older and they are dying, are you then saying that you also agree with Dr. Young? That even if they're suffering and
right, I do agree with Dr. Young. That I mean, I can fully understand why a patient would want that, but we're not the ones to be doing it. Is sort of my
you're
take
not
on
that,
it.
But you're not being the one to do it because they're asking for it. They're the one that actually physically take the cocktail. It is not, they're not getting an injection. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So they have to swallow this.
Right, but you're providing it for them.
Do you think that someone who really wants to die won't be able to find a way to die anyway? It's like the woman who in the old days, there was, you know, abortion wasn't legal. Women found a way to have an abortion.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there's data on it or anything. I know that, you know, that there was recently a paper in the New England Journal about suicidality in patients who've been diagnosed with cancer and how it is initially, you know, a sort of a high risk following initially the diagnosis, and it tapers off with time. So, again, you know, you sort of worry that you don't want to grab someone at a dynamic moment,
right,
and then, you know, prevent them or have them not be able to put their affairs in order in a way that's useful.
Right. You know, this is an entirely new path, and change can be scary, you know, and so, but, you know, if you knew that you could take something that would put you to sleep, if you were in so much pain, both physical and emotional, don't you think to some degree that would be reassuring? It's like the person who is suicidal. I mean, oftentimes people don't commit suicide. They fantasize about it, in essence. They're not really suicidal. They want to find a way out. And so fantasizing that they have that out. Because even in the Oregon laboratory, if you will, it turns out that not really as many, not all the people who asked for this lethal injection, or excuse me, lethal cocktail, really actually took it. Is that right?
That is true. That's what the data shows, yes.
So wouldn't it make sense that they really just want that as a way to reassure themselves that if they absolutely have to get out, that they can get out?
I think it's hard to second guess what any patient wants or what anybody wants, but I know that if there is data, especially from Oregon, where I think it's about 2/3 actually did utilize the prescription that was prescribed for them.
2/3.
I think I'm not that certain, but there is data for that.
Mm-hmm.
And our concern is, what did the other third or more do with that medication?
So what do you think they did with it?
I can imagine that it was laying around. If they disposed of it properly, that would maybe that would have been the best possible thing. But then I get concerned about if it's laying around, who else has access to it?
What is it that stands out in this act that makes it just so incomprehensible? I'll just throw it out there. Either one of you can answer. I mean, what is it that just, you know, makes it so that it's just so unbearable to imagine, that it just seems so wrong to you?
I think I have to go back to just the ethical issue of, you don't have the right to kill somebody.
Oh, I, you know, I
but I even though they want it, and I think that it's It's difficult. Mm-hmm. And but I can also share with you that the medical society has this policy, as I had said, mm-hmm. and it is the AMA policy that you just mm-hmm. that you had read.
Right.
And we had a reaffirmation, we call it. It's a policy that we've had for quite some time. And every 7 years, we take a look at our policies. So this came up, mm-hmm. not because of any of the issues going on in the public venue, but mm-hmm. just within our own society. And there was some very interesting debate on our House of Delegates floor. There were it passed by about a little over a two-thirds margin, mm-hmm. but the one-third were very eloquent and had some very good points. In answer to your question about aren't they going to find a way otherwise, there were several psychiatrists that got up and spoke and said that, yes, indeed, they do. They end up either with a gunshot wound,
right.
with asphyxiation, hanging themselves, with bleeding out. They end up finding a way how to mm-hmm. do this.
Absolutely.
And they felt that the humane way for them, and this was not the majority of physicians, but the humane way was to legally be able to prescribe something. Now, it is being done, but mm-hmm. physicians do this, and they risk being sued because of this.
Right. I have a comment that came in from my website, Ann and Wayland. Until I do some research on the matter, I can only give you my feeling in all caps. But before I get close to that place in life, I should be able to say in writing, so she's very clear about that, my wishes are, if I am in unbearable pain with no hope of a life with quality or my participation to laugh or cause others to do so, when the living of life is no longer possible, I would like to be able to painlessly end the state I'm in, be it a vegetative or a conscious incapacitated state. She continues, we are all going to die. To the extent the beating of a heart and other bodily functions by artificial means, when there is no possibility of living, actively, conscious living, I think it's cruel and unusual punishment for those of us that want our death. And to be very clear, I want the option, not the government, not my family or any other person or agency to have the right to make the decision. There you go. So, you know, It almost, you know, I'd like to give in to my social instinct, but I won't. I almost feel like by saying, no, you can't do this, it's like playing God. I mean, shouldn't we be able to be in charge of our lives, our own bodies? I mean, there's, you know, the Death with Dignity Act has to collect so many signatures. I think it was something like 69,000, and they collected 84,000. So obviously, there are people that are really feeling very strongly that they should be entitled to this.
I mean, I think it's not unreasonable, and what your viewer wrote was very articulate, and I agree with all of it.
I didn't write that. No, I didn't write
what
that.
Your viewer wrote.
Oh, my viewer wrote. Yes.
I guess my issue is that it shouldn't be in the hands of the doctor. And so as Dr. Young had said, you know, we take an oath when we become physicians to do no harm. And this is fundamentally inconsistent with that.
But doctors are in control of it because they are controlling, it's the palliative care to get rid of the pain and to take away the oxygen bit by bit. So in a sense, they are doing it themselves, aren't they?
Well, that's this double effect thing that I mentioned earlier.
Right. So in a sense, they really are.
Well, it's really tricky, and you need to be clear about intent. And so the intent for someone who's short of breath with lung cancer and who's feeling uncomfortable, you increase the morphine to make the breathing slow down and relax so that mm-hmm. the patient is no
right.
longer feeling so breathless.
Right.
But you have to fully realize, as do the patients and the families, that there is a risk that they will stop breathing altogether.
Right.
But again, it's not the ending the life.
Right.
It's palliating the symptoms that's driving it.
Well, that seems like semantics to me. It really does. I mean, it really, when you get right down to it, it does. But treatable pain is not the only reason, nor the most common reason why patients seek to end their lives. There's severe body wasting, right? There's intractable vomiting, urinary and bowel incontinence, right? All these things, immobility and total dependence. And there's a real growing awareness of a loss of dignity. And I think that is just, you know, it's like you come in a baby, and it's almost like when you get to that point, you're going out a baby, mm-hmm. right? And I mean, I think that's really a horrible thing. It's bad enough that you know you're going to die. To have to go through that, it doesn't seem compassionate to me. It does not seem like a compassionate, and to some degree, I do have some mixed feelings the more I really kind of looked into this. But, you know, I have witnessed someone be very sick and dying, and it's really very, very sad. It's a sad thing, and I think that it's not, I think that any compassionate human being would pray, you know, please, you know, like, let this person go, because it really is horrible to watch. And it's not, and oftentimes it's sad because the people feel like they are a burden. And that probably is one of the main reasons that they want to take this lethal cocktail. Am I wrong? Am I right? I mean, I think that's probably
probably right.
And I think that that's something to very much be concerned about, clearly. Right? I mean, we don't want people to start feeling like, I've got to drink this because I don't want to be a pain in the neck to anybody anymore. And I understand that and appreciate that. But you know what? When you love a person when they're sick, they're not a burden. They are, you just don't want them to suffer, because it's so sad. It is so unbearably sad.
Well, can I just bring up a point, especially going back to what your viewer had written, that there are methods. There's the healthcare proxy. There's the living will. Mm-hmm. Where if you are in an accident, or if you do have something that becomes debilitating, a neurologic mm-hmm. problem or whatever,
right.
that you do have something in writing. But even so, those do get challenged. And I think that those are some of the issues that we struggle with. I would look and say, you know, if I'm in an auto accident and there's really no hope for me, don't put a tube in me to make me breathe, and don't feed me, because I just don't want to live like this.
Right.
That already is in place.
And that's right. It is. And, you know, we've learned to grapple with many slippery slopes in medicine. I mm-hmm. mean, the do not resuscitate is what you're talking
yes.
about, obviously,
yes.
right?
That's
you know,
part, yes.
Withdrawing from life support. But we don't deal with those slippery slopes by prohibition, right? I mean, but well, rather by adopting reasonable ground rules and setting appropriate limits. So how is that different?
Different from what's going on with the...
With the Death with Dignity Act, yeah.
I don't think there... I think the difference is that the Death with Dignity, or physician-assisted suicide, whoever you want to look at it, there is a willful cognitive in the physician-assisted suicide to end life, where perhaps not prolonging it necessarily, but making them pain-free mm-hmm. and making... And they're imminently going to die anyway.
That's right.
So letting the disease take its course, but making the patient as comfortable as possible.
So you're in favor of letting the disease show its full expression. Yeah, I mean, that's really what
I don't think any of us are in favor of disease.
That's not quite where we went.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's almost like that's what it's doing. It's allowing the disease its full expression, and there's really no need for that, you know, extra whatever, 10 days mm-hmm. or 2 weeks or...
I mean, so as a sidebar, working in the hospital with people who are quite sick, people frequently change their mind about their code status and their DNR mm-hmm. orders.
Okay. Yeah.
And so, you know, and you will have had a patient in the office who seems very clear that they don't want life support mm-hmm. If they were to be in a situation where their condition were irreversible or they would require a ventilator, and then admitted to the hospital with shortness of breath and panic and say, of course I want everything done. And so
yes, so, I hear you. I know exactly what you're talking about.
And the opposite yeah. is true, too.
Yes,
we can
yes.
have folks who say, no, I'm full code, and then they get in the hospital.
They
and
go,
they
just let it go.
See how sick they are, and they, oh, please let this end.
You know, it's an interesting thing. It's sort of a little esoteric, a little spiritual here. But, you know, when people are ready to go, they're ready to go anyway. Mm. you know, how many times have you heard the story? Someone is, you know, someone's had a major heart attack and they're going to die or whatever. And it's like, but, you know, they didn't go until that last family member flew in. How is that? So there's something a little bit, right? So when you get right down a wish, now I'm going on the other side, right?
We're convincing you.
Well, I don't know that you're, you know, I'm just really having a conversation about it because, you know, initially I felt like, no, you know, this is it. If it's time for someone to go, it's time for someone to go. As I looked into it, I mean, it is a slippery slope. I mean, there's no two ways about it, you know, and, you know, let me ask you a different question. How has this changed the quality of pain management? Has it changed it for the better in any way? Just knowing?
Well, I would say, so I've been practicing for almost 20 years, and over that period, there's been a dramatic increase in clinical knowledge regarding the priority of managing people's symptoms at the end of life. And so, you know, I think that palliative care is up and running, mm-hmm. and they do mm-hmm. amazing work. Mm-hmm. And so you had mentioned the individual who's incontinent and mm-hmm. feels a burden and loss of dignity. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, palliative care teams are amazing. Mm. I mean, they are so great. You know, and I'm thinking of the hospital I work at, but you know, this is something I've heard from other folks as well, and I had a grandmother die in hospice, mm-hmm. and her care was, you know, impeccable, and she, you know, it was just wonderful that, mm-hmm. that they were there. So I think that shouldn't be ignored, mm-hmm. and right. that and I wouldn't want the physician assisted suicide to preclude further developments in palliative care. Now, I know Dr. Angel is going to be on, and she's going to say that they can go in parallel, which is true. Mm-hmm. Palliative care can still evolve.
Right.
That this doesn't say that it's not, that it's unable to happen.
I have some questions here from listeners. Linda Lolly from Marblehead said, if dogs can be euthanized, why can't people? Well, I think that was really more of a comment than a question, really. But
because people aren't dogs.
Wow, wait a minute. Now we've got an entirely new topic.
She is so smart.
Well, I have a dog, and I have often said that it's a human in a fur coat. But anyway, okay, Christy in Boston, Dr. Lamont, you have a duty to relieve suffering if you can. How are you doing that if you insist on keeping a suffering person alive? Well, I think we've already been kind of talking about that.
Right. I mean, we're not. It's sort of, you think of omission and commission, and mm-hmm. commission is mm-hmm. giving the drug, and omission is removing life support.
Right.
So you know, I think you're still caring for the patient.
Okay, Dr. Linda Young here. Dana in Winchester, the end-of-life decision is difficult. There is no simple answer, never will be, but a patient is entitled to have their voice heard, and if this is what they want, who are you to decide?
Well, I think that that's a very good point. And I know in this particular death with dignity that there is something there for if the physician who is caring for the patient is uncomfortable with what the patient wants, the physician can, what we call opt out, can say, I'm very uncomfortable, that's not what I believe I need to do, and can back away from giving any kind of a prescription that would end their life. So that's number one, that the physician can mm-hmm. definitely opt out. Mm-hmm. Who am I? I think one of the things that I look back on, and with practice, with being in the hospital, with seeing patients, and within your own family, we always have hope. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we're wrong.
Well, you know, I do hear that. I mean, every once in a blue moon, you do hear someone who has you know, they've got 6 months to live, and 10 years later they're still alive.
Kicking, yeah.
Well, I actually have a friend who was given that diagnosis many, many years ago, and now it's something like 15 years later, and she's still doing very well. And you know, she actually went sort of the alternative route. And has continued that way. And I know if there's ever anything that doesn't feel right about me, I call her first. because, boy, she has some good remedies. But anyway, okay. All right, here's another one, Dr. Lamont. No name. Fear versus love. In life, we come from either a place of fear or a place of love. If we are loving, we care. We allow humans to be human and love them, whether we believe in their choices or not. If we are not doing this and trying to stop them, we are coming from a place of trying to control, which is fear-based. What dire consequences are you afraid of?
It's funny because I think of caring for people at the end of life as very nurturing and loving, and that you're trying to help people to feel as well as they can for as long as they can, help have them connect with friends or family if they haven't in the past. And, you know, honoring their wishes with the advanced directives is acknowledging their autonomy.
Okay. All right. Well, you both have been very, very helpful. Is there anything before we say goodbye to our listeners that you would like to add?
Can I just give a little more with palliative care?
Yes.
Because it's not just medication. It involves the family. It includes spiritual care. It includes emotional care. So it's not just, let's give them pain medicine and have them zone out and let their disease kill them. It's much, much more than that. So it's very, very compassionate. And I think that it is certainly a good alternative to helping them end their life, maybe prematurely. It's hard for us to decide how long a patient has to live.
And Dr. Johnson's right that palliative care teams at places in Boston are comprised of physicians, some of whom are pain specialists, anesthesiologists, some oncologists, some who are palliative care specialists, but also nurses and nurse practitioners and chaplains and social workers for whom this is their job. They take care of these types of patients exclusively, and they really know their stuff. And I've just seen so many beautiful endings in situations where you think things would be quite difficult. The palliative care team has very wonderfully swept in and helped make things much, much better.
Thank you, Dr. Elizabeth Lamont and Dr. Linda Young, for being on Talk with Francesca today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, Dr. Marcia Angel, petitioner for the Death with Dignity Act, and Heather Klisch, whose father's choice was to end his life. He drank the Secanol solution from one of his scotch glasses, all straight ahead when we come back.